Welcome, everyone, today to our webinar called Bridging the Gap in Public Understanding of Climate Change. What can scientists do? And today we are really honored to have two illustrious speakers today, Erin Hurtis, Press Secretary at Union of Concerned Scientists. Erin graduated from George Washington University with a degree in political communication and mass media. And I didn't mention my own name. I'm Brenda Eckwurzel, and I'm a climate scientist here at Union of Concerned Scientists. And I really enjoy co-managing UCS's Weight of the Evidence project with Erin. And this project elevates the voices of scientists and researchers to help demonstrate the real-life consequences of a changing climate. And today we're also going to have presentations from Susan Hassel, who is Director of Climate Communication, and she is universally renowned as a science communicator with deep knowledge and background on climate communication. She also has helped author several federal national climate assessments, been there since the beginning, and these are some of the clearest, most lucid distillation of how climate change is affecting the United States, and some of her earlier work on the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment. And many of you may have seen her giving presentations about how to talk about climate science at an institution near you. So without further ado, Erin, could you start the webinar, Bridging the Gap in Public Understanding of Climate Change?
Hey, thank you so much, Brenda. And did you want to briefly say hi, Susan?
Yeah, hi, Susan's here too.
Okay, great. So the presentation today, we're going to cover some best practices that we've identified for communicating climate change to public audiences, to lay audiences, from a scientific perspective. So what we'll cover are some of the gaps in public understanding. There's four big ones, and some of the underlying public opinion data that helps us understand what the shape of that gap is. So I want to talk about some of these gaps first. And we'll hop deeper and deeper into it and go over these four important subject areas. And Susan and I will be trading off a little bit as we go along, and hopefully we'll have some time at the end of the presentation to help answer some of your questions and hear some of your comments. So when we talk about gaps between scientists and the public, it isn't just climate change. It's a whole range of issues where scientific knowledge in society is really far away from what the public understands about those scientific topics. And that can have a huge impact on the public policy choices that we make. So one obvious one that people will be talking about for a long, long time and have been talking about for a long time is the gap in scientists' understanding of evolution and the public's understanding of evolution. So this is one of my favorite interpretations of this gap from Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal, a science-based cartoon series. And I want to share a polling result that was done by AAAS and Pew, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the Pew Center for the People and the Press. And they surveyed AAAS's general membership as well as the general public, and they compared the results of these two surveys. So among this general scientific population as represented through AAAS, 87% endorsed the idea of evolution through natural selection. So a very high scientific consensus. Only 32% of the public shared that same view. And that's one of the biggest, most persistent gaps in public understanding of science is on evolution and natural selection. Another example they asked about was on vaccinations. So they asked if vaccinations should be mandatory, if parents should have to vaccinate their children. So it was more of a policy question. So again, among the scientists, there was a very high level of consensus. 82% of scientists said, yes, vaccines should be a requirement. And there's a smaller gap here for the public. 69% of the public agreed that there should be vaccination requirements, that parents should have to get their kids vaccinated. A smaller gap, but a more troubling one in some ways, because if parents pull their children out of mandatory vaccination programs or choose not to have their kids vaccinated, we lose herd immunity, and that's happened in some communities in the United States where there's been a disproportionate number of parents who have missed out on the science and have pulled their kids out of these vaccination regimens. So this is all to say that climate change is not unique in these gaps, it's important to know the shapes of these gaps and why they occur. So the next slide I'm going to show you combines a lot of public opinion data on the question of climate change. So just absorb this graph, these series of trend lines for a second. What you're looking at are the results of a bunch of different public opinion polls that asked the basic question, is global warming happening, in a lot of different ways. One of the chief things you run into when you look at public opinion data is that how a question is asked can vastly affect the type of responses that you get from the public. So what Tony Loserowitz at the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication did was he combined a lot of these onto the same graph so you can see some of the big, broad trend lines from these different public opinion polls. So the first thing you see, the highlight in yellow around 2007, is a general increase, no matter how the question is asked or who the audience is that you're asking it to, a general increase in understanding around that era that climate change is happening. Now, of course, this was the era of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports. It was when the Nobel Peace Prize went to the IPCC and to Al Gore. So this was an era of high public attention for climate change. And we see this start to decline around 2010. Over this time period, the policy debate around climate change became more politicized, and that started to affect how people were thinking about the science of climate change broadly in the public. We also had a really cold winter. We also had some big snowstorms, things like that. We know that those can impact public opinion one way or the other. In any case, there's a dip around this time period into 2010. There's a nascent rise in public opinion again that's ongoing. So you see this top line here, a recent Reuters poll showed a good increase in the public understanding of climate change. We also saw a recent Gallup poll just last week that's not reflected in this chart yet, but the Gallup poll showed an increase too. One of the things that the Yale folks do is they sometimes partner with George Mason University and also do some really good public polling information on climate change. And I want to show you the results of questions they asked about who the public trusts when it comes to information about climate change. So the bad news is there's a gap. I want to share with you some of the good news. So to put this in context, this is another public opinion poll from a partnership with Yale and George Mason, and they asked, how much do you trust the following as sources of information about global warming? And you can see these results change a little bit over time. So the mainstream news media, less than half the public trust them on this topic. And that's true for people's general impressions of the media across a range of topics. We're a nation of media critics. We generally don't trust whatever the mainstream news media is telling us in the abstract. In reality, it's where we get a lot of our information. Religious leaders fare a little bit better than the mainstream news media as a source of information. Again, just for perspective, less than a majority. TV weather reporters enjoy majority plus trust from the public when it comes to climate change, global warming as a topic. People tend to trust their weather reporters. And here's the really good news for scientists is that scientists enjoy the highest level of trust when it comes to climate change, global warming. So 80%+ in the most recent survey when they asked this question. And another thing to know here is that the public really doesn't discriminate all that much between different scientific disciplines. For a lot of members of the public, they don't approach it the same way scientists do, which is to know the discipline, the sub-discipline, who's that very precise subject matter expert. For the public, a scientist is a scientist is a scientist, for better or worse. And I think it's really good to know in any sort of public communication opportunity you have that the public does very much trust scientists. And this is true across different types of polling information. So when you ask people which professions they trust generally on any topic, scientists finish near the top of the list, along with medical professionals, along with police officers, first responders, nurses, you name it, people who are engaged in these public service type fields. And ironically, at the bottom of that is members of Congress and members of the media, right? So the public has very high levels of trust for scientists, lower levels of trust for other folks who are communicating to them a lot about scientific and technical topics. And this presents a paradox. Why are these gaps so persistent if the public has a high level of trust in scientists? and a guy named Michael Turner, a physicist speaking at the Aspen Institute, really put it well. I love how he synthesized this. He said that the public's appreciation for science is a mile wide and a nanometer thick. And this is the paradox I think any scientist deals with when they're trying to communicate publicly about a scientific topic. You're starting from a position where people want to hear from you. They will trust what you have to say, and there's a willingness to listen to you. The problem is that their knowledge about that field, even at a basic level, is going to be a nanometer thick. So our job is to try to deepen that. And Susan and I are going to dive into, like I said, the best practices we've identified for deepening that understanding when it comes to climate change. So here are the four broad topics we're going to cover. The first, these are the top four gaps that we see in the public opinion polling. So the first is the public doesn't, these are the four things the public doesn't get. They don't get that it's happening now. They don't get that it's us, that human activities are driving climate change. They don't get that we have a choice when it comes to the future emissions that we see. And surprisingly, they still don't get that there's wide scientific agreement about a changing climate. They don't get that. And if we can increase, if scientists can help increase public understanding on these four points, that would go a long way toward helping us as a society having a more rational and useful debate about what to do about climate change. So let me dive into the first one here. It's happening now. So people don't understand that climate change is occurring right now and that climate change has been going on, that human-induced climate change has been going on for a while. How do we know that? Well, again, I turn back to the Yale George Mason polls. If you're looking for public opinion information about climate change, this is the absolute one-stop shop for figuring out how the public thinks about these issues. So here's the result of a polling question they asked in November 2011. When do you think global warming will start to harm people in the United States? That was the question. So about 30% of the public says it's happening now. Climate change is harming people in the United States now. And I combined a few of the other answers here to show you that this middle bar, more than half the public thinks that climate change is something that's happening at some point off into the future. And it's about an even spread here among 10, 25, 50, or 100 years. So people really have this framed in their head as something that's going to happen to us later, not something that's happening now and is ongoing. So this is a really big gap. And, of course, we have about 15% of the public who says it's never going to happen. They're very dismissive of the science overall. So when we try to emphasize what's happening with the changing climate and the fact that it's happening now, there are some really good ways of doing that. So one way that we've been using recently at UCS is to talk about this generational shift that we're seeing in folks who were born today have been living under a changing climate for a while. So this is how we say it. 2011 was the 35th year in a row that the global temperature was above average, right? This is standard data. What that means when you look at the census figures in the United States is that half of the American population has never lived through a year that was below average. Or to put it another way, you're not living in your parents' climate anymore if you're under 35, if you're 35 or under. You're definitely not living in your grandparents' climate. So this is something that's been going on for a while and is going to continue to go on. There's a couple other really good ways to talk about this, and for that I want to hand it over to Susan, who's going to cover a few of those.
Thanks, Aaron. So I would just say first that one of the reasons it's so important to help people to understand that this is happening now is for them to connect the dots between what they're experiencing with their own senses and what they're hearing from scientists. So if any of you have taken the Myers-Briggs testing, you know that there are these dichotomies, and there's one of these dichotomies. It's between sensing and intuition. Scientists tend to be heavily on the intuition side. The public, broader public, tends to be heavily on the sensing side. They take in information and make decisions based on what they can see and feel and sense. So that's one of the reasons it's important to help people realize, you know, anyone who's lived in the same place for a couple decades has felt the climate change, and we have to help them make the connection between what they've experienced and what's happening. So one of the things that I think is really important to help people understand is that climate change is not a straight line. It doesn't get warmer every single year. It's not warmer than the year before. That scientists look at these decadal averages and look at 30-year periods to get a sense of trends. Any of you that have been looking at the Wall Street Journal or some of the other news outlets lately have seen lots of contrarian pieces, op-eds and so forth, that harp on taking some, cherry-picking some small part of out of the record and saying, well, it's actually been cooling. This graphic really puts the lie to that. This comes from the NOAA National Climatic Data Center, and what it shows is that we have just come through the hottest decade on record, that every year of the past decade was hotter than the average of the previous decade, and that every year of that decade was hotter than the average of the previous decade to that. We know that climate is warming on the long scale, long time scale, and it doesn't matter if you can pick out a particular year or even a particular series of 7, 8, or 9 years and try and show a downward trend. That's a little bit of a myth of cooling inside a long-term reality of warming. And so one of the things we have to get people to understand is, and we like this graphic for this reason, because it shows the warming on a decadal scale. I should also mention that climate models do show certain realizations of climate simulations, show these hiatus periods where you get a little bit of a leveling off within the long-term warming trend. So that's not unexpected, and it doesn't mean that the models are wrong. In addition, I would say that we are adding heat to the system, and if you don't see it in the surface temperature record, you still see it somewhere else in the system. In this case, most of the time, you're seeing it in the oceans. So ocean heat content is still going up. That heat's not disappearing. It's just going into the oceans where it's going to come, from where it's going to come back to haunt us later. So I thought this graphic would be a good one to show you to put that in context. I think it's also worth noting that even if we had no thermometers, we would still know that the world is warming. There are lots of indicators of a warming world in addition to air temperature. There's humidity, that's atmospheric water vapor. There's the temperature over the oceans, the sea surface temperature, the ocean heat content, sea level. All of those things go up in a warming world. And then there are certain things that go down in a warming world. And that those include, of course, sea ice, snow cover, and glacial mass. And so this is a cartoon, again, from NOAA and CDC, National Climatic Data Center, from the State of the Climate Report, that gives you a quick overview of those. And then when we break that down just a little bit more, these are 7 of the indicators that I mentioned that all increase in a warming world. And what you see here is how many sets of data there are from different groups around the world for each of these topics. So this is not, you know, one center with one record. This is, in some of these cases, half a dozen different sets or more on each of the things that I mentioned that go up. And then on the next slide, there's the three things that are going down. So, you know, what we know is there are lots of indicators. People, contrarians, tend to like to fixate on a particular thing like the surface temperature record, and they, you know, make comments about poorly sighted stations or, you know, other things to do with that record. A really good way to just get around that is to say, look, that's not the only way we have of knowing. We've lots of other ways, and here are some of them. So we wanted to point you to this resource in terms of pointing out to people that the impacts of climate change are happening now. This report was published in 2009, Global Climate Change Impacts in the United States. It's available online. It goes through in a fair amount of detail every region of the country and every sector of the economy, you know, water and energy, transportation, agriculture, human health, and so on. And what it does is really put in very plain, simple, clear language what we know about climate change at the global scale, at the national scale, and how it's affecting us now in every region. So really, this is just a highly recommended resource that's in really plain language. So I think I pass it back to you now, Aaron.
Yeah, thank you so much, Susan. And just to reiterate, I mean, for me, any anytime someone asks me about local climate change impacts, I'm pointing them back to globalchange.gov and a lot of the great work that Susan and others were able to accomplish there in translating the science into what is meaningful for the decisions that folks need to make on the ground today that are impacted by a changing climate. There's a lot of great graphics there. There's a lot of stuff that's short, easily accessible, very easy to read, very easy for scientists and non-scientists alike to understand and utilize. So that was the first of the four big gaps that's happening now. The second one is helping people understand that it's us, that the climate change we're witnessing now links back to human activities. So, of course, when we look at the emissions that are contributing to warming, the three big ones that stand out are burning coal, burning oil, and destroying tropical forests. Now, there are other types of greenhouse gases, obviously, besides carbon dioxide. There's other sources of emissions, definitely. I think for the public, the question that we ask is, are they getting the big, broad message that, you know, carbon dioxide is going to be trapping heat, hanging out in the atmosphere for a while, and that we're transferring a lot of carbon from the ground up into the atmosphere. So I'm going to share with you some data, again, from a Yale George Mason poll, and they gave people a big list of things that might be contributing to climate change. And they gave them ones that were correct, and they gave them ones that were incorrect to see where the public was at on this. And they gave them four options. They said, does it contribute a lot, some, a little, or not at all to climate change? So what I pulled out of that was just the a lot and some, the people who were taking these various things and attributing some role to climate change, to global warming from these different sources, different activities. So when we look at these big three, 69% of the public gets that burning coal for energy, our power plants, these sort of things do contribute to a changing climate. Using oil in our cars and trucks, oil to drive transportation, 73% of the public really gets that connection. And that's the high water mark. That's the most attributed thing. 63% of the American public makes the connection to tropical deforestation. It makes sense that this would be a little bit lower since a lot of that is happening overseas and people pay a little bit less attention to things that are happening outside of the U.S. borders generally among the American public. So this is sort of good news. These are pretty high. They could definitely be a lot higher. But look what happens when you compare it to other sources, that other options people were given as potential sources of climate change. We've got 54% of the public saying that aerosol spray cans contribute to a changing climate, 61% that say the hole in the ozone layer is contributing to a changing climate, and finally 43% think the sun has a lot to do with it. We see this happen across polls when people are asked, how much does human activity or natural variability have to do with the climate change we're seeing now? People attribute a lot of different things to a changing climate. They conflate climate change with a lot of other problems scientists have identified with how human activities are affecting the environment. The ozone hole is a big one. And a small but significant portion of the public in this poll said that shooting rockets into the atmosphere was contributing to a changing climate. So people are pretty confused about what's causing these changes to our climate. So the question for scientists is, what do you focus on to help drive home these big major connections? And I say that knowing that we probably can't educate the public about all the different types of greenhouse gases, all the different types of potential climate drivers. That's really hard knowledge to convey over and over again. And I think we have to emphasize some of the biggest trends and the stuff that has the most impact on the climate that we're seeing now and that we'll see in the future. So from a scientific perspective, it's going to be the growing amount of carbon in the atmosphere, right? We have this long record of the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. We see its annual variability, but we see it climbing and climbing and climbing over time as we destroy more tropical forests and burn more fossil fuels. And what we know from public polling data and from focus groups is that if you talk about this as a carbon problem, if you talk about overloading the atmosphere with carbon and with carbon dioxide, and if you emphasize a too much carbon message, that really sticks with people because it gives them a mental picture of what's happening. It allows them to make the connection between what we're doing in our power plants and our cars and to our tropical forests and what's happening to the Earth more broadly in response to that as the climate changes. So really focusing on that one big thing first and leading with that. If you have the opportunity, you can talk about other stuff, but really leading with the biggest drivers of climate change and emphasizing those helps make that connection for people. And there's a second piece to this that also emphasizes the mechanism of what's happening, and Susan is going to talk to you about that.
Okay, so as Aaron said, lots of people don't understand the basic mechanism of climate change. They're confusing it with ozone depletion and so on. So one of the most important things we can do, I think, is use the term heat trapping. I actually prefer it to the term greenhouse gases. So just substitute heat trapping for greenhouse. I actually have a picture that says, greenhouse gases are causing global warming. Destroy a greenhouse today and help stop global warming. You know, people just don't know what we're talking about, I don't think, necessarily, when we say greenhouse gases. It's a metaphor, and it's not even that good one. So I call them heat-trapping gases. It emphasizes that Earth has a natural heat-trapping blanket around it of carbon dioxide and other gases, and that by adding more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere by burning coal, oil, and gas, we're increasing that heat-trapping blanket. And again, you know, studies and focus groups have shown that that metaphor of thickening the heat-trapping blanket is one that people get and helps them to understand the mechanism. And I think we should just be constantly reinforcing that mechanism since we know it's not well understood.
Thanks,
Aaron,
Susan.
You want to pick it up again?
And you reminded me in the repetition of these things. Some of this might seem like old hat to some of you who are listening in and on the call. And I picked up an old phrase from a friend who's worked in communication for a while, and the phrase was, when you get absolutely sick of repeating your same message over and over again, it's at that point that your message is probably sticking with the public on some level. This stuff really does bear repeating over and over again anytime you have a public communication opportunity.
I really agree with that. And if I could add one more thing, Ed Maybach at George Mason is always saying that the secret of good communication is this: simple, clear messages repeated often by a variety of trusted sources.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an excellent definition. And I'm sorry to say that I think the contrarians have embraced that definition and done a very good job with it, and our community has maybe not done as good a job with that as we could.
So we've covered it's happening now, making that clear to people that the human activities are driving the climate change that we see. The third big gap we see is that people don't understand that we have a choice when it comes to the future extent of climate change. Climate is often presented to them as something that's locked in, and there's a lot of despondent communication around climate change that obscures the choices that we are faced with as a society that'll have a huge impact on what future climate change looks like. So please take a moment to read through these polling results. This is again from Yale George Mason. And the question was, which of the following statements come closest to your view? And people were given four different ways of thinking about this. So in the first case, we have 4% of the public that's very optimistic, that says we can reduce global warming and we're going to do so successfully. The biggest chunk of the public here says that humans could reduce global warming, but it's unclear if we'll do what's needed. I think a lot of us would agree with that too. We have 25% of the public that takes a somewhat despondent view that says we could reduce global warming, but people aren't willing to change their behavior, so we're not going to. 15% of the public say, you know what, we couldn't stop it, even if it is happening. That's a very despondent, pessimistic view. And finally, 10% who are a bit lost to the whole conversation who say, it's not happening. But when I look at that 25% and that 15%, those are folks who really would benefit more from knowing about the choices that we have when it comes to a changing climate. And why this despondency? I think it's worth diving into this a little bit. If you just do a simple Google image search for climate change, you come up with a lot of images like this. And I think these are very representative of the visual images that people are confronted with online and through visual media, especially television, whenever you see a story about climate change. So think if you're coming to this issue fresh and you want to understand whether or not we can do anything about a changing climate, these are really negative images. The Earth's on fire, your cities are underwater, and there's just sad polar bears everywhere who are dying because of climate change. That's visually what the public is being told. And I think that something can be done to change that visual story a little bit. But more broadly, I want to illustrate this just to understand where the public is coming from and why there's some of that despondency. What these images tell them, and what some of our own communications unfortunately sometimes tell them, is that climate change is happening, there's not that much we can do about it, and we're all just going to have to suck it up and deal with it. And we know that's not the truth. We know that there's huge differences in a low-emissions future and a high-emissions future, and we can do some stuff to illustrate that. And, Susan, you had a really good example of that from the last National Climate Assessment.
Yeah, and so just before I go to that, I'll add one thing. When you ask Americans, and I probably could do it with all of you, say, close your eyes and think about global warming. What's the first thing that comes to your mind? And for almost everyone, it's melting ice. And so what I would like to see is not only that we present a story that's more positive about the choices we face, as we're going to talk about now, but also that we help people bring that closer to home. This is not just about melting ice at the poles. This is about the, you know, heat waves and wildfires and, you know, increasing heavy downpours that can lead to flooding and a whole bunch of things that people are experiencing in their lives. So I think that really a way to improve our communication around this is to try and change people's image of this being about something else, something far away, dealing with other people, and something that's much more in our own backyards. So as Aaron said, in the National Climate Assessment in 2009, we tried wherever we could to show the choice we face between a lower emissions future and a higher emissions future. So what this map shows is the number of days over 100 degrees Fahrenheit as we've experienced it, and what we would have under a lower emissions future. In this case, it's B1 of the SRES scenarios, and A2. So, again, a higher emission scenario, but actually not as high as we're currently. We're currently tracking close to the A1FI, which is an even higher scenario than this one. So the reason I like going this way as opposed to sort of just a prediction showing a single future is I'm afraid that locks in people's minds the idea that there's nothing we can do about it. So my suggestion to you is wherever you can, always talk about the difference between a lower emissions future and a higher emissions future. We do have to admit that there's a certain amount of this that's already in the pipeline, and the world is going to continue to warm, but there's a difference between bad and worse. And I think these maps really help illustrate that, and throughout this report, in the 2009 report, we tried to call that to attention whenever we could.
And I would add to that, you made me think of one of my gripes I see a lot of times in media coverage of climate change, and sometimes it's because of how a study was potentially released to the media or how a university press office handled something, or sometimes the study design itself. But a lot of studies look at a single emission scenario. They look at what's going to happen in 2050 or what's going to happen in 2100. And one unfortunate consequence of that is when those findings get communicated to the public, they get communicated as, you know, Wisconsin will look like this in 2050 or Wisconsin will be like this in 2100. And that really obscures the variability that could happen with emissions in the future. And that variability is something that we have control over. So I think that's always something to watch out for, even at a very basic level of trying to figure out how can I usefully design a study so that people can understand, you know, what some of the potential impacts are of climate change in the future.
That's exactly right. It's the difference between a prediction and a projection, projection being based on a particular scenario. You also reminded me that I think the word inevitable is very dangerous. I've seen it in the titles of papers. And, you know, as a group, we tend to say things like, well, this is inevitable. And while, as I said before, while we know that some amount of it is inevitable, I think we have to be very careful with words like that and be very clear that we do face this choice.
The final aspect of this, this idea that we have a choice, is that people tend to think of climate change as something where, you know, we need some great solution that's going to come out of the sky and fix the problem. People want to believe that to some degree. Or on the opposite side, they believe that that's never going to happen, so they feel despondent about it. And one thing we can do is to help illustrate what some of the solutions are that are already being used today. And this is something we wind up saying all the time, that the solutions are happening in the real world right now. In addition to working with climate researchers, UCS works with a lot of economists, a lot of clean energy experts, a lot of folks who do vehicles engineering. So we work on a lot of this stuff, too. And I think that when you point out to people that wind is increasingly becoming a part of our energy supply, that more solar panels are being deployed and employing more people, and that we're making our transportation infrastructure cleaner, that we are making progress, that we're probably not doing, we're definitely not doing enough to avoid the worst-case scenario projections, but to show that real solutions are happening in the real world, that helps them understand what taking that lower emissions pathway could look like, and that that lower emissions pathway is possible, that it is a choice and an option we have now. And I really like to point back to the example of hybrid cars, like the Toyota Prius pictured here. When hybrid cars came out, there was a lot of doubt about whether or not they would get any significant market penetration. And now we have more than 1 million of these cars on the road. They really have outstripped expectations. So when you take something like the Toyota Prius, it's gone from a novelty to ubiquity. It's something you see on the road every day. So reminding people that this new technology, as it gets introduced, the stuff that the technical experts and the businesses try to get over is getting penetration of that technology into the market and to get this stuff online. And they are successfully doing that in some cases. Obviously, we need to do more, but showing people that steps have been taken to try to take down some of those emissions, that's been good. That has been workable. So this is the other big piece to talk about when we talk to the public about climate change is the simple fact that scientists agree. So this picture is from one of the American Geophysical Union meetings. The public doesn't get to see this. They don't get to see the depth and the breadth of scientific research. They don't get to be in the room with hundreds or thousands of scientists at the conferences. Most people don't know a scientist in their own personal lives. So it's really easy for the public to buy into this idea that there's a ton of scientific controversy around the topic, not just climate change, but really any topic. And, of course, we've seen that knowingly exploited by opponents of action on any problem that scientists are pointing out, trying to find a handful of scientists who can dispute it and just hammering that home as much as possible. And the public doesn't get it. Here's the Yale George Mason poll again. This is a national average, and this is asking about the scientific consensus. So 34% of the public says that most scientists think global warming is happening. 40% more than agree with reality. 40% say there's a lot of disagreement. We've got 5% that think the opposite of reality, that think most scientists say global warming is not happening. And we've got 22% of the public that really just feels agnostic on the whole thing and says they don't know enough to say. And if you dive a little bit deeper into this data, one of the really interesting things that you find is the Yale George Mason folks, they characterize 10% of the public as alarmed about climate change, folks who are really tuned into this, really think we should do something about it. That's 10% of the population that you would think would know that most scientists agree. But in fact, a little less than a third of them still think there's a lot of disagreement among scientists. They just don't care. They think we should be doing more anyway. But when you look at this broad national-level public opinion data, this is one thing that really prevents people from understanding what scientists have to say about climate change, just knowing that there's agreement. So how do you talk about agreement? Well, there's a lot of ways you can do it. So I want to walk you through some of those ways here on the slide. So on the left side, there's two studies that were big surveys of scientists who work in the field, and they found widespread agreement among scientists. So the first one is an EOS survey, and it found that among climatologists who are active publishers on climate change, 97% agree that human activity is significantly contributing to global warming. Below that, there's a PNAS study that looked at different scientists, how much they publish, are they uncertain or are they certain about the role that human activity has to play in climate change. And again, that found 97 to 98% agreement, human activity is largely driving climate change. I think it's okay to point back to these surveys. I'm not sure they're as good as the ones we have on the right side. I'd love to see more public opinion polling data that helps drive some of this home and lets us know what works. What we do know now is that emphasizing this is important. So on the right side, what you have are the scientific authorities who've weighed in on this, right? We have our own National Academy of Sciences. We have scientific agencies like NOAA. We have scientific societies like AGU that have released statements about climate change. We have the United States Global Change Research Program, which combines a lot of that federal data and what the federal agencies have to say about climate change. And finally, we have the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, organized through the United Nations. And I've organized these a little bit. I've purposely put IPCC at the bottom because I think a lot of Americans have an innate distrust of that which is international, and a lot of Americans don't want to hear about anything that's come from the United Nations, unfortunately. I think the National Academy of Sciences is a really good example to pull out because it is our national academy. We can point back to its history, the fact that Abraham Lincoln founded it, and the fact that it's the main hub, essentially, for scientific advice to government. And you can also talk about all the broad consensus that comes from these different types of groups, right? You can talk about the National Academy of Sciences, the federal scientists, the independent scientific societies, academic scientists. If you kind of put it all together, scientists really do agree, and you've got to find a couple ways of emphasizing that. And Susan, you had some other thoughts on this, too, on conveying the consensus.
Oh, I think you pretty much covered it.
Okay, great. So this next slide is an attempt to sort of synthesize a little bit of this advice and show you some examples of how you can talk about this stuff in a short way and kind of give you a starting point for adapting this to any communication opportunities you might have. So for it's happening, just to be able to say that climate change is already underway. And to Susan's point earlier that we can see the results in our own backyard, I love what you had to say about the idea that you really have to relate it back to people's senses, their memories, stuff that they're going to be able to form a mental picture with. Secondly, burning fossil fuels in our cars and power plants and destroying forests, tropical forests in particular, is overloading the atmosphere with carbon. And that second part, that it acts like a heat-trapping blanket around the Earth. So emphasizing the carbon and talking about the heat-trapping blanket, both very important pieces. That we have a choice, that the decisions we make today will largely determine how much climate change we face. And finally, you know, if you're starting with the National Academy of Sciences, pointing out that our own National Academy of Sciences, which was founded by President Abraham Lincoln to advise the government on scientific matters, agrees that human-caused climate change is already happening. So these are the big four. And I do want to hand it off to Susan again here. Susan's done a great service to the scientific community, I think, by identifying some areas where scientific jargon can actually obscure the meaning of the findings of climate science. She's developed some really wonderful resources that I'm excited that she'll be able to share with you now.
Okay, so just very quickly, one of my favorite subjects are these words that mean completely different things to the public than they do to scientists. Now, these words are much more dangerous than jargon. Jargon's bad enough. That's words like anthropogenic, which people don't know what it means, so you should just say human-caused. But these words are worse. These words are words that the public does know what they mean. They just mean something completely different. So this is Rush Limbaugh, and he is spraying aerosols on the globe because he heard that aerosols cool climate, and so he's doing his part for global warming, to reduce global warming by spraying aerosols. Now, of course, you know that to the public, an aerosol means a spray can. So every time you say aerosol, when you mean small particle or atmospheric dust or whatever other term you want to use for it, you should use those other terms because the term aerosol is not working terribly well and actually reinforces the misconception that people have and the confounding of ozone depletion and climate change. Similarly, scientists use the word enhance to mean to increase, but to the public, the word enhance means to make better or to improve, as in enhance your appearance. So the enhanced greenhouse effect sounds like a good thing. So instead of saying enhance, you could say intensify or increase. Also, to the public, positive means good and negative means bad. So a positive trend is a good thing. And, of course, in climate warming, a positive trend is not a good thing. Just say upward trend. If for the public, positive feedback, that's a good thing. If you go do something good at work, your boss gives you positive feedback. So a positive feedback to the climate system, you might want to say a vicious cycle or a self-reinforcing cycle. Much more effective. And so the word radiation means X-rays and Chernobyl to the public. You might use heat or energy instead. The word theory is a particularly dangerous word because for the public it means mere hunch or speculation or guess. It doesn't mean what we mean when we talk about a theory in science. So that's actually one of these words that I suggest avoiding altogether in discussion of things like the greenhouse effect or human-induced climate change. So there are many, many more of these words. I've got a list that's over 100 terms long for these words that mean something different. I don't expect you to absorb them all. What I really want to do is sensitize you to the concept so that you can be aware of this. I published an article recently in Physics Today with my colleague Richard Somerville, and in that article, which you can download at my website, by the way, the website's climatecommunication.org, and this article is published in full. You can just download a PDF of it. We put this table of words, the scientific term, the public meaning, and a better choice. And so I just suggest that you download that article. It's also full of other good advice around communicating around climate change. So what works? You know, we've talked about some of the things that don't work, some of the things that do work. A few other things I think are important, and I'm going to have to do this very quickly because this is something I would normally spend, you know, a whole day working with a group of scientists to develop this. But just quickly, it's really important to connect with people on values. So for people, most people, as Aaron said, don't know a scientist personally. So for them to understand that you share their values, that you want to be, you know, good stewards, that you care about the world that you're leaving to your children, I think that's really useful. I think it's also important to craft just a few key points. Sometimes I think scientists try and fit everything in and end up giving too much detail. And really, the more you say, the less they hear. So if you can just force yourself to be masters of exclusion and to just craft a few really key points to keep those messages simple and to make them memorable, and the way to make them memorable is by using imagery and metaphors and stories. Those are the things that people remember. They don't remember facts, they remember stories. And there's a huge number of metaphors that I've worked on and other people have worked on that I think are much more effective. So lead with what you know. When somebody says, so did climate change cause this heat wave? You don't want to start by saying, well, what we can't say is, and what we don't know is. What you can say is, what we know is, in a warmer climate, as the average temperature goes up, the extremes shift as well. We get a greater number of hot extremes and a smaller number of cold extremes. In fact, we've been breaking two heat records for every one cold record over the past decade. And over the past few years, it's been more like 3-1. You can lead with what you know, say climate models have long projected this, and we know that what we're doing by loading the heat, by loading the atmosphere with heat-trapping gases is we're increasing our chances, we're loading the dice towards more of these kinds of roles. So lead with what you know, not with what you don't know. And include solutions. And when I say positive solutions, I mean try not to frame it in a negative way, as in regulation, restriction, reduction, and cuts. Instead, talk about ingenuity and entrepreneurship and competing for the clean energy economy of the future. Frame the solutions in positive terms. Talk about what we're already doing that's working. Find the bright spots and scale them up. It's just a much more positive way to tell the story. So I see a lot of questions that have come up, and I'd actually like to try and answer some of those. I saw somebody ask the question about the fact that among Democrats, the higher your level of education and the higher your level of scientific literacy, the more likely you are to accept the science of climate change. If you're a Republican, it's the opposite. The higher your level of education and the higher your level of scientific literacy, the less likely you are to accept the science of climate change. And somebody asked the question, can you help us make sense of this? Why would that be? Well, Dan Kahan and colleagues at Yale have looked into this, and they say that what drives people in this way is they want to conform their views to those of their social group and their cultural group. And because climate change has become such a partisan issue, and the leadership, on the conservative side in the Republican Party, has taken an anti-science position on this, people are being individually rational by conforming their views to those of their own cultural group. And that's why we believe we're seeing this kind of trend. So there are so many other questions. Aaron, do you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I saw a neat question from Eugene Dejonius. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name. You asked if the public understands that CO2 stays in the atmosphere once emitted for a very long time, and I was able to look that up briefly. So that was in one of the Yale George Mason surveys. So the question was, on average, how long does carbon dioxide stay in the atmosphere once it has been emitted? So 64% of the public said they don't know. They have no idea. So most people definitely don't have any idea how long the carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere. 6% said 1,000 years, 13% said 100 years, another 13% said a few years, and 4% said a few days. So as far as directly answering your question goes, no, the public is tuned out to that fact. I wonder, Susan, I'm not sure.
I'll weigh in on that. I can weigh in on this a little bit, too. I think they don't, clearly, from what Aaron just said, get it. It's a confusing topic, potentially, because, of course, some of it lasts a very short time. Some of it lasts essentially forever. And so I think one of the best ways to talk about it is to say carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for centuries and even millennia, for thousands of years, and some fraction of it stays in there essentially forever. David Archer from Chicago has said that it's essentially like nuclear waste. Some of it is there forever. So I think we really do need to impress upon the public that once the carbon dioxide goes in, it stays there for a long time. You know, this depends, too, on the setting, whether you have time to talk about, you know, issues of the carbon cycle and how, you know, there are also things that are removing carbon dioxide from the system, but that they're not keeping up with the increase that we're causing. And maybe that's enough said for now on that.
Mm-hmm. And there's another question from Mira Shanaker, and she asked about communicating about climate change to policymakers in the current environment. And I think that plays into a little bit of what we started to get into with the research about sort of motivated reasoning and how people are able to search out information that matches with their preconceived views. My opinion is it's worth addressing head-on when you run into it, and to really emphasize to people that scientists are doing their jobs discovering facts about the world around us, and that carbon dioxide doesn't care who you vote for, doesn't care what party you identify with, and it really emphasizing the unique role that science has to play in society and in some of these debates. And I think it's also worth, especially in interpersonal communication opportunities, being somewhat direct with people about that and saying that it shouldn't be an overly politicized issue. It can be kind of a touchy subject and one that I think we're all searching for answers for. I wonder if you have some other thoughts on that, Susan, that you've picked up on.
Well, I think what you said is exactly right. Richard Somerville likes to say there are no Republican or Democratic thermometers. And when people ask you if you believe in climate change, Jerry Meal says, it's not a matter of belief, it's a matter of evidence. Another scientist I know says, when somebody says, do you believe in global warming? He says, I don't believe in it, I measure it. I think there are a lot of good answers to this, but what we have to impress upon people is that this is not a matter of opinion or belief. And whether you believe it or not, it's happening. It's a matter of evidence and fact. I actually avoid the word consensus because I think it unnecessarily makes it sound like it's about opinion, which it's clearly not.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I saw some questions about how do we know that it's us? You know, what kind of facts to use to explain that it's us? One of the things that I find that's effective in responding to that question is, different things that affect climate, we know that the sun affects climate, of course, but we've been measuring the sun very, very carefully. We see an 11-year solar cycle, no upward trend, so it can't be the sun. Also, we know that different things that affect the climate have a different pattern, a different fingerprint on the climate system. So, for example, if it were an increase in the sun that were causing this increase in temperature, you'd see increase in temperature at the surface, in the troposphere, and in the stratosphere, all the way up through the layers of the atmosphere. But that's not what we see. What we see is warming at the surface, warming in the troposphere, and cooling in the stratosphere. And that pattern of vertical temperature change is a fingerprint that the warming is caused by the buildup of heat-trapping gases in the lower atmosphere. So that's one of the things that I find that's very useful. Another one is to explain that we use climate models not only to predict the future, but also to look back and understand the climate of the past. And when we use those models in that way, we can put in and take out the various factors that affect climate. So when we run the model for the past 100 years and we take out the human factor, we see that the climate actually would have cooled slightly. Only when we put in the human factor do we see a perfect match of the warming that actually took place and what the model would project with the human factor. That's another way we have of knowing.
Andrew Jacobson had a question that I think both of us get a lot, and the question was whether or not the survey results have different results if we use the terms global climate change versus global warming.
This is an interesting question, of course, and it's not by accident, because climate change is something that scientists use to talk about any kind of climate change, not just human-induced climate change. And the public picks up on that. And, in fact, the Republican strategist Frank Luntz told the Bush administration during those years to use the term climate change because it sounded more natural and less scary. So the term global warming is a little more loaded because it seems to imply for people the human causation. But because global warming is a loaded term, I tend to use the term climate change, but I say human-induced climate change to be clear that that's what we're talking about. What are your thoughts on that, Aaron?
I don't see huge differences in the surveys as they're used. What I do see is that for the 10 or so percent of the public that's already predisposed toward rejecting the scientific consensus on climate change for ideological reasons, they really do pick up on the difference between global warming and climate change, and they've taken the fact that scientists don't consistently use one phrase when talking about this to accuse scientists of, changing their minds and, oh, you can't call it global warming anymore because the globe got cooler, you know, don't you see? So that sort of thing. So I'd say generally it does contribute to some confusion. We've had journalists harp on this in our interactions with them. John Holdren, the head of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, he likes to use the phrase global climate disruption to put the emphasis on sort of what's the impact on society. I haven't really seen any polling data that looks at that. So I tend to use climate change, too, because global warming brings up some of those associations like we were talking about earlier of, melting ice sheets somewhere and the polar bear and other stuff that's not happening here at home.
Right. I like Holdren's climate disruption a lot, and I use it, but I think sometimes you have to use a term like climate change or global warming just to let people know the topic you're talking about, and then I switch to climate disruption. I think it's good, and I think better than global warming, it captures the whole range of things that are happening, including the increase in heavy downpours and rising sea levels and the other things that happen when climate changes.
Yeah. So I think we covered a lot of ground. We're almost at about 3 o'clock, so I just wanted to cover the summary slide, which you all see here. If you have any follow-up questions, please email sciencenetwork@ucsusa.org. I believe most of you, if not all of you, are members of our Science Network. If you're not, please join. If you are a member and you have some colleagues who benefit from being members of UCS, please let them know they can join us and point them to our Science Network. This is part one of three of the communications webinar series we're doing, where we polled members of the Science Network like you to ask for the sort of stuff you wanted to focus on. So our next one is going to be cures for the PowerPoint blues and some best practices for making dynamic presentations. That's going to be on Thursday, April 19th from 2 to 3 Eastern, on clearing up climate confusion, dealing with some of those pieces of misinformation and other stuff that scientists often run into. That's going to be on Wednesday, May 16th from 1 to 2 Eastern. And this link that some of you have seen earlier that points back to our scientist guide to talking with the media, please do check that out if you get a chance. Just this past couple months, we've turned that book into a brochure that you can keep in your desk and, take out any time you have a public communication or media opportunity. There's tips there for distilling what you have to say down to 3 or 4 critical messages. And that's been flying off the shelves at scientific conferences that we've been to lately. It really is information that I think you and your colleagues could benefit from. We're happy to send you copies of that brochure in the mail for you to be able to distribute to your colleagues. And again, that points back to our book, A Scientist's Guide to Talking with the Media, which remains a great resource for really any technical experts who are trying to communicate to broad publics. And I really wanted to thank you, Susan, for coming on board. I think you've been a leader in helping people, especially scientists, communicate climate change more effectively. And I'm just so happy that you were able to share your expertise with our science network. And we'll be looking forward to having more star guest speakers like Susan for these other two presentations.
Thanks, Aaron. If I could just say one last thing, I see that a lot of people have asked about talking to policymakers. And we don't have a lot of time here, but I would just say one thing, that good communication is more of a conversation and an engagement and less of a lecture. And my experience is that any one of you could have a really great conversation with a policymaker who might in public might not be willing to come out and take a stance on this issue, but if you were having a private conversation with them and you were responding to their questions and their concerns, I think we could make a lot of progress that way. So I'd suggest that to you.
Thank you, Susan, and thank you, everybody, for participating. Brenda, I don't know if there's anything else we wanted to say in closing. Is there?
No. Thank you, everyone, for taking valuable time today, and we will get you the slides if you email at the Science Network, as Jean suggested. Thank you so much, everyone, for today.
All right. Thank you all.